Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN, the Independent Voter News. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests so you can develop your own more informed opinion. My guest today is the Honorable David M. Walker. For nearly 10 years, Mr. Walker served as Comptroller General of the United States and head of the United States Government Accountability Office under Presidents Clinton and Bush 43. In fact, he received presidential appointments from Presidents Reagan, Bush 41, and Clinton, and was unanimously confirmed by the United States Senate each time. Try to imagine that happening in today's political environment. Mr. Walker is also the author of several books, including his latest that asked the question, America in 2040, still a superpower? Which we discussed the last time he was on the show. He recently updated that book to reflect some of the major domestic and international events that occurred through the end of last year, and we'll discuss his insights in those areas as well as many others. Dave, as always, thank you for joining me on Deconstructed.
Good to be back with you, TJ.
Dave, when you updated your book, you included your anticipation of Russia's actions in Ukraine. Given that the phrase, quote, "no one could possibly have known," unquote, has become a mantra of the current administration. What did you anticipate and how could you possibly have known?
Well, I didn't know for certain, TJ, but it was pretty clear to me that after the embarrassing withdrawal from Afghanistan, that served to embolden both Russia and China. And Putin has been very open with his ambitions to try to recreate part of the greater Russia that existed for many centuries. And so, I believe that Putin perceived weakness on behalf of the United States, and as a result of that, he tried to take advantage of it. I said in the update in the book, which, by the way, was written in December, so I didn't know for sure what was going to happen. I said that I didn't expect that Putin would take any action if he was going to take action until the Olympics were over, and sure enough, right after the Olympics, he moved in. And since then, I've said, you know, people have speculated as to what his goals are. And in my view, his goals were not to attack NATO. I think he would never want to attack NATO, especially after the poor performance of his military, but that he wanted to take, annex part of eastern Ukraine, create a land bridge to Crimea, try to topple the government in Kyiv, put in a more friendly government, and then have western Ukraine remain a sovereign nation, but serve as a buffer between Russia and NATO. And obviously he underestimated the Ukrainians, he overestimated the ability of his own military. And now my real concern is he can't afford to quote unquote lose. And so I just hope that he doesn't turn to tactical nuclear weapons as a means to try to gain a battlefield advantage and therefore have much greater leverage in any negotiated settlement.
Dave, in the revision of your book, you also address possible future action by China. What are those actions, and again, upon what do you base your projections?
Well, first, as you recall in the book, I talk about what's the definition of a modern-day superpower, and I posited that it was a country that had global economic, diplomatic, military, and cultural influence. And I said that I didn't think Russia met those criteria, and clearly that's even more the case today. But I did think that China met those criteria. And China obviously has ambitions to restore its greatness in the world, not just within its region, but beyond, as evidenced by the Belt and Road Initiative and a number of other strategic initiatives that they have. And what I did say is I felt that China was emboldened by the embarrassing exit from Afghanistan and the perceived weakness of the United States, and that they were likely to take Taiwan within the next several years. And I think people need to keep in mind that, you know, just like Ukraine, we don't have a treaty with Taiwan. Ukraine's not a member of NATO. NATO doesn't even exist in the Far East. And so I think that China is watching the Ukraine situation very closely, but I would expect that eventually that they're going to make an attempt to take Taiwan. The question is, what are we going to do about it? I think from a practical standpoint, what we can do is learn the lessons of Ukraine and make sure that Taiwan is fully armed so that they can do the best they can to protect themselves and to deter China from trying to do that through force. But from a practical standpoint, while there are things that we could do, it's very unlikely that we could prevent them taking it over if they ultimately decided to do so. It's kind of like China telling the United States, that they're going to prevent us from taking over a Caribbean island if we wanted to do that, which we have no intention to do it, but we could if we wanted to.
Dave, back in 2012 when I was running, I created a thing called the Freedom Process to try and help people understand the interaction between various different policies. It was an acronym, Freedom was, for foreign policy, resource policy, which by resource I meant energy and the environment, education policy, economic policy, defense policy, operations policy, or the operating efficiency of government, and ministerial policy, things such as immigration, healthcare, social security, social services, etc. Dave, every element of the freedom process ties into our nation's economic policy, and your experience puts you in a unique position to connect those dots. For example, when you talked about the revisions in your book pertaining to Russia and China, you effectively tied foreign policy to economic policy. So let's do the same thing with respect to other policies. In that regard, the president released his budget on March 28th, and I'd like to explore it with you. But before we get into any of the details, I'd like to first ask you, when is the president's budget due by law?
The president's budget is due the first Monday in February. And obviously the president is given additional flexibility in their first year in office, but this is not his first year in office. This is his second year in office. And for the record, he's 7 weeks late.
And this is under, it's 31 USC section 1105A that dictates that that's the date that it's due. CBO is actually required to score it by February 15th. So that's going to be a little difficult since we're already at the end of March and going into April.
Unless they're thinking about next year, TJ.
Yeah, really. When is the congressional budget due? When is the congressional budget due?
In April. And obviously that's not likely to occur. You know, look, TJ, as you and I have talked about, the budget appropriations process is badly broken. I'm 70 years old. It's hard to believe, but I am. And Congress has only passed a timely budget and all the appropriations bills 4 times in 70 years. That is an F minus. And they're not going to do it this year either, in all likelihood.
The administration's been touting that the economy grew by a record 5.7%. as the U.S. added more than 6.5 million jobs while digging out from the coronavirus pandemic last year. How much of that is realistically attributable to the administration's policies?
Well, first, this is another example of something that's technically accurate, but grossly misleading. The fact is that we had a recession and we lost a lot of jobs as a result of the effects of COVID-19. And in fact, we could have recovered quicker and could have recover jobs quicker had the government not ended up paying people so much money not to work and engaging in other restrictive policies with regard to the workplace. And so the fact is we did recover economically, but that was largely rebounding from a contraction. And we didn't create as many quote unquote new jobs as what the administration asserted. A vast majority of those were basically refilling the jobs that already existed. And the real question is that not where we've been, not where we are, but where are we headed? And based upon current economic policy, you know, the CBO and other Congressional Budget Office and other organizations believe that we're going to face very anemic long-term economic growth if we don't put our finances in order.
In fairness to the administration, we have established a few economic records recently. For example, our country has been hit with 7.9% inflation, which is the fastest rate of increase in 40 years. And earlier this year, the national debt topped $30 trillion for the first time in history. Yet, we're told that the new budget will reduce debt over the next 10 years by over $1 trillion, based upon the administration's expectation that the rate of inflation will decline rapidly. What's your take on that?
I do think that inflation will abate over time, but I don't think it's a temporary phenomenon. The fact is that we need to be able to take steps to be able to get debt as a percentage of the economy down to a reasonable and sustainable level. We also have to be careful as to how much of the budget is represented by interest, for which we get nothing. Fiscal policy has been unsustainable. Monetary policy, quite frankly, has been aiding and abetting irresponsible fiscal policy. The Fed has kept interest rates artificially low. The Fed has purchased almost all of the new debt issued by the United States during these challenging periods. And so as a result, now it's in a situation where it's going to have to reverse course, probably not as fast as it should, in order to tame inflation. So I think the administration's economic assumptions are very optimistic. And I think our situation is a lot more serious than they would lead you to believe.
Well, Dave, we're going to take a quick break and we'll talk about other economic elements of the freedom process when we come back. Welcome back. My guest is the Honorable David M. Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States and author of the book that explores the question, American 2040, Still a Superpower? Dave, we were talking about the budget within the context of the freedom process, but first I want to do a level set. It's a $5.7 trillion spending budget with an anticipated $4.3 trillion in revenue. And yet it's supposed to reduce debt over the next decade by $1 trillion. So help someone like me understand how we accomplish that.
Well, first, it's a one-year budget, and then they have projections over what I think the longer-term implications are. But importantly, the difference between 5.7 and 4.3, the last time I checked, was 1.4. So that means that the debt is going to go up $1.4 trillion in the first year. And presumably, he's projecting that he's going to reduce the debt as compared to the so-called baseline. And basically, what he's saying is he wants to raise taxes, and he's using rosy economic assumptions with regard to economic growth. And therefore, you know, we're actually going to, you know, reduce relative debt burdens over time. The problem is they're already too high. We need to reduce it much more than anybody's projecting. And in order to be able to do that, you have to reform mandatory spending programs, including social insurance programs. You have to reprioritize and reduce projected spending for discretionary spending. And you have to engage in comprehensive tax reform that will generate more revenues. You have to do all of those things. You also have to reform government to focus on more economy, efficiency, and effectiveness than is being proposed. And so this budget is a proposal. It proposes, Congress will dispose, but neither the president nor the Congress is as serious about what needs to be done to put our finances in order, and that needs to change. Because if you can't put your finances in order, your economic position over time will suffer. If your economic position suffers, your diplomatic power will suffer. Your military capability will be eroded, and your cultural influence will wane over time. And those are the four elements of a superpower.
Now, Dave, you and I have championed a cap on debt-to-GDP ratio for years. And you recently wrote an article called Stop Crying Wolf About the Debt Ceiling and Resolve It Once and For All. Give me a quick synopsis of what was contained in that article.
Well, first, the debt ceiling limits the statutorily, in other words, by law, not by the Constitution, but by law, as to how much debt the United States can take on. And it's a number, you know, it's a nominal dollar number. The joke about it is that Congress every year ends up passing budgets that by definition are going to end up resulting in the need to increase the debt ceiling limit. I mean, the president just proposed a budget that has a $1.4 trillion deficit, which means more debt, if you will. And so we're the only major industrialized nation that has a so-called debt ceiling limit. It has failed miserably. It was intended to try to constrain the expansion of debt. It's not done anything close to that. And so what we need to do is to recognize it's a failure, and we need to move from debt ceilings and from balanced budget approaches to limits on how much debt as a percentage of the economy we can take on. That's a credit card limit. And to set a lower target of debt to GDP than where we are now that we want to try to achieve over a number of years through various reforms. And we need to do that not just statutorily, we need a constitutional amendment that takes that on, which I've been involved with, because that's the only way that you're going to be able to assure that we'll ultimately achieve it. All the statutory approaches that have been taken in the past have failed.
Dave, let's jump to that. You've also written an article on that constitutional amendment and the need for transparency. That's kind of the operations policy, the way it would fit within the freedom process. Talk about that constitutional amendment and what you're trying to do.
Well, under the Constitution, Article 5 of the Constitution, there are two ways to get an amendment. One is the old-fashioned way, which we've used 27 times. Two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate pass a proposed amendment. They send it to the states. Three-quarters of the states have to ratify it. When they do, it becomes an amendment to the Constitution. But the founders also recognized that Washington could become so out of touch and out of control that the states would need to reassert their rights under the Constitution. And it provides a second method. And that second method is if two-thirds of the states file an application with the Congress for a convention to propose amendments. Now, let me underline that. A convention to propose one or more amendments, not a convention to rewrite the Constitution, but only to propose amendments. If they do that, and two-thirds is 34 states, then the Congress shall set the date and place for a convention. They have no discretion. I've been involved with an effort that recently has discovered that we passed that 34 number in 1979. We hit a peak of 40 states in 1983, and yet Congress failed to act. And therefore, there are several efforts being taken to try to be able to either A, force the Congress to set the date and place for a convention to propose a fiscal responsibility amendment, or in the alternative for the archivist who's independent to provide a certified statement as to how many states we have. And if we have 34, then Congress has to do it. If we don't have 34, how many do we have? So that we can end up making sure that we take the steps to get the required number. This is fundamental, and it's probably the most significant fiscal issue, arguably in history, but clearly since the Simpson-Bowles Commission, which unfortunately was not successful.
Now, Dave, we've talked about debt. There's a difference between debt and deficit. And in the latest budget, it was suggested that the deficit will be $1.3 trillion lower in 2022 than it was last year. And that would, again, celebrate the largest one-year decline in U.S. history coming off massive spending to combat the coronavirus pandemic and economic fallout of that. What's not right about that comment?
It's technically accurate and grossly misleading, like most PIPA politicians do, and frankly, too many media outlets. You know, look, I mean, we had incredible one-time spending to combat COVID, of which, by the way, there was a tremendous amount of fraud, waste, and abuse associated with that, which has not been given enough transparency and accountability. And then we obviously didn't achieve as much revenues because of the impact on economic growth. And so therefore, when you have a recovery, you end up generating more revenues. And when you end up getting rid of the extraordinary one-time spending associated with a quote unquote national emergency, then, you know, obviously your deficit's going to go down. But the whole point is he's still projecting a $1.4 trillion deficit without that emergency spending, which is way too high.
Dave, we're going to take another quick break and talk more about elements of the freedom process when we come back. Welcome back. My guest is the Honorable David M. Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States and head of the United States Government Accountability Office under Presidents William Jefferson Clinton and George W. Bush. Dave, we were talking within the context of the freedom process about the president's new budget. Now, on the resource policy element, he's talking about $3.3 billion for green energy projects, $18 billion for climate resilience programs across the federal government, and $11 billion in international climate finance. How do you think that will impact foreign policy, for example, because China's the world's largest provider of PPE and pharmaceuticals, but also rare earth minerals that are used to create a lot of the new solar technologies and so forth. And in that same vein, how do we deal with recycling those same rare earth elements? Do we have solutions, or are we just pushing forward without an end game?
We don't have a comprehensive plan. The fact of the matter is that we are overly reliant on China for many things, including rare earth materials, including manufacturing of pharmaceuticals. And by the way, one of the reasons that car prices are so high right now is because of the semiconductor problem. And who's the largest manufacturer of semiconductors? Taiwan. And so that has obviously significance with regard to what China's future actions might be. Look, there's no question that we need to do more onshoring. There's no question that we need to be taking a number of steps to try to decrease reliance on China, increase our self-sufficiency. But there's no comprehensive plan. It's going to take us a number of years for us to be able to get there. And by the way, you're talking about some of the numbers with regard to climate. Look, climate's a real issue and does play some role with regard to that. The amount of money he's talking here, frankly, is a small fraction for what he's already spent through so-called COVID legislation, which had nothing to do with climate, but there was a lot of climate money in there. And one of the things we have to recognize is that we've got to transition over many years to alternative fuels, and that right now we ought to be energy independent. We were energy independent as recently as 15 months ago. Now we're not. By being energy independent, we can do a lot, not only with regard to holding down gas and other fuel costs, but we also help our European allies to be able to reduce their dependence on Russia and other despot states like Iran. And so what I'm disappointed with is, yes, climate is a real issue, but we have to recognize that we need a plan that balances the interests of the economy with climate considerations. And that means we need to be doing as much as we can to be energy independent from an economic and national security perspective and have a much longer time frame on this transition than the administration is currently planning.
Dave, you've done an excellent job of tying the economic policy element of resource policy, and you've even tied it into defense. Because in the defense element of the budget, one of the things that the president's asking for is $6.9 billion for European Deterrence Initiative and NATO and other efforts to counter the Russian aggression. He's asking for nearly $1 billion for State Department, USAID, and the Department of Defense to provide assistance to Ukraine. So all of these blend together. Where would you see the appropriate budgeting for the defense policy, and including things such as inflation?
We've got to get control of spending. We've got to be able to have a more reasonable monetary policy in order to be able to deal with inflation. Our excess spending and our unsustainable monetary policy are the primary contributors towards inflation right now. Yes, we have supply chain challenges. There's no question about that. To the extent that we can deal with those, that'll moderate the inflationary impacts. But the primary drivers are the two things that I just mentioned. We have to recognize that we face a real, serious, peer competitor threat from China, and that China is a superpower. It has broader ambitions, and therefore we have to be able to make sure that we are spending an adequate amount to provide a real deterrent to China, to provide more peace and security in the world against authoritarian regimes like Russia and Iran and North Korea. At the same point in time, I'll tell you that we're spending way too much money on overhead at the Defense Department. It's a bloated bureaucracy. We need to dramatically reduce the amount of overhead that we have in the Defense Department so that we can sharpen the tooth, which is our warfighting capability. We also need to move away from as much reliance on manned vehicles to unmanned vehicles and leverage new technologies in ways that can help us be more effective to the extent that we have to engage in armed conflict. And I think we have to, frankly, project much more strength than we have during the last year or so. And I think because we haven't projected that strength and we seem to be leading from behind is the reason that, you know, authoritarian regimes have been emboldened and are taking some of the steps that they're taking.
Dave, let's talk about supply chain for a minute, because for an instant in time, it was being blamed for some of the inflation, and which was going to resolve itself over time. Now we hear that it's Russia's fault that we're suffering from inflation. But in the supply chain element of the president's budget, he's calling for, listen to these numbers carefully, $230 million for port development, $1.7 billion for Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund, an extra $125 million to help bolster domestic manufacturing, and $200 million for new solar manufacturing. What do those numbers suggest to you, having dealt with the federal budget for as many years as you did?
Out of total spending of $5.7 trillion, it's chump change. I mean, look, do we have a comprehensive, integrated plan to be able to address a number of the challenges that we face? The answer is no. The United States does not have a forward-looking, threat, risk, opportunity-based, resource-constrained strategic plan. It never has. It still doesn't. Despite all of the challenges that we face in the world, despite our financial and other challenges that we face that only get worse with the passage of time, the closest thing to one that exists is the plan that I put together for the GAO in 2000, its strategic plan, which gets updated several years. But we need one for the executive branch. We have a national security strategy and a national military strategy, which is a piece of what a plan would be. And that's in the process of being updated right now, which will be changed because of significant events over the last year. But we don't have anything with regard to the rest of the government. And it's far past time that we had it.
Now, there is an element of the new budget that I personally doubt will pass muster and will make it through, but it's going to be very fashionable. The administration claims that it alone would reduce the deficit by $360 billion over a decade, and that's the billionaire minimum income tax. Now, I think it's fashionable because who likes billionaires, right? They're only like 500-something out of 335 million people in the United States. But it would require households with more than $100 million to pay 20% of their total income per year. That's not as offensive as an element that focuses on 20% of unrealized gains. Help explain what unrealized gains are.
Well, a lot of billionaires are entrepreneurs, and in many cases, they're founders of very, very successful enterprises, you know, whether it be Amazon, whether it be Tesla, whether it be Microsoft, just giving you three examples. And in many cases, their wealth largely exists in the holding of stock in those enterprises that have subsequently gone public. And under current tax laws, you don't have to pay taxes on gains on that stock until you realize them. In other words, until you sell the stock. To the extent that the price keeps on going up, there's no quote-unquote income other than the dividends you might receive off of the stock. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying, rather than going for a wealth tax, which is something else that's been talked about, which would be a very small percentage of accumulated wealth, whether it's realized or unrealized, they're trying to be able to deal with it through income. The problem is there's a difference between realized and unrealized income. Here's the bottom line. There's no question in my mind that there ought to be a higher effective tax rate for billionaires. No question in my mind. The question is, in what form? What's enforceable and what's constitutional? And I think there's going to be a real big debate about how can you get there. Some people want a wealth tax. Some people want this approach, which is a minimum tax on earned and unearned income. Some people want a minimum tax just on earned income. And ultimately, I think something will happen, but I'm not convinced that we've got a proposal yet that meets all three of those criteria.
Dave, I think one of the challenges I have with the unrealized gains approach is that this also extends beyond stock. With stock, I think some people would look at it and say, well, that's fair. They realize what Elon Musk did in selling off 10% of his Tesla stock and so forth. But this also applies if somebody had artwork or a car or something like that that escalated in value, they would be able to tax 20% of that escalation. The question becomes, who decides what the unrealized gain is? We had Enron a number of years ago, very famous situation where they did mark to market, which was the exact thing. They were projecting unrealized gains. So who decides in this case?
That's not very clear. And the other issue that you have is one of the challenges that we have with the tax system to begin with is when you end up having realized gains, you report what you sold it for, which the government gets reporting on. The government knows how much money you got from selling it. What they don't know is, what did you pay for it? And so the other issue you have is, well, who's going to decide what the basis is? And how are you going to assure the reliability of the number that is determined for the basis? So it's not just what the value is, it's what's the basis.
Well, Dave, we haven't had an opportunity to get into some of the ministerial policies and the economic impact, like immigration, healthcare, Social Security, Medicare, so
forth. All the little things.
All the little things. So we're going to have you back on. But in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and pick up a copy of your book?
Well, if they want to pick up a copy of the book, which has recently been updated, they can go to Amazon, they can go to Barnes & Noble, or they can go to the publisher, which is Author House. It's available online. It's just in time printing. I do have a website, deficitranger.com. I am on LinkedIn. I am on Facebook. And so those are some of the ways that they can end up finding more about me and follow some of the things that I'm doing.
David Walker, as always, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. You bring a unique perspective and have the experience and expertise to back it up. I wish all of our nation's leaders had your ability to dissect the issues in a nonpartisan way and identify common sense solutions. So, Dave, until next time, thank you for joining me on Deconstructed.
Thanks, TJ. My pleasure. Love to do it again.